This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. You know that one friend who always finds the best travel deals, picks the right cards, and somehow ends up in first class for the price of coach? Well, Smart Travel is like that friend, but in podcast form. They cover all things travel finance, like which airport lounges are worth it and which are basically free Wi-Fi and chairs, and how travel advisors can snag secret perks you didn't even know to ask for, or how to get real value from points, not just a tiny reward at checkout. Travel smarter and spend less with help from Nerd Wallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
And welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer. There are iconic sites around the globe that people base their entire vacations around. But how much do we actually know about these attractions? Well, my next guest knows a hell of a lot. He has written a delightful new book. It is called Hidden in Plain Sight. I hope you can see that. The subtitle for that is The Untold Mysteries, Myths, and Marvels of the World's Most Popular Landmarks. His name is Ronan O'Connell. He's joining me from Perth. Hey, Ronan, thank you so much for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Pauline. It's really great to be here to have a chat with you. Thanks.
Sure. So tell me, what gave you the idea of doing this book?
So I actually hadn't thought about doing a book before. And one day I just got an email from HarperCollins in the US who reached out to me and said, would I pitch them some ideas for books? And basically this was in line with the type of travel writing that I'd been doing for years, which was trying to find, unusual elements of history or cultural heritage or architecture, like things that when people go to popular locations are kind of right there in front of them, but they might not necessarily notice. And so they asked me, they said that they liked that style, but that they needed something obviously that, is marketable. So I came up with the idea of, okay, well, let's go then to the world's greatest landmarks so that it gives something for people to really hook into. They see the Eiffel Tower, the Colosseum, all these things. But then let's try and actually find some of, as it says in the title there, some of the mysteries and the myths that people just do not notice when they're there, or things that they might look at, but they might not even realize that there's a really in-depth story behind that. And for me particularly, I think it was motivated by the fact that, I've got a young son now and I see him on the internet and he seems to always think that he's got the answers to everything. I try and tell him about things. He goes, yeah, no, Dad, I saw that on my phone or I saw that on TikTok. Huh. And, the smartphones and the internet are giving us this sense that the world is very knowable, that it's become very shrunken, and that all the answers for any question you might have, you just can type into your phone and the answer will pop up. And so, it kind of has taken a little bit of the romance out of the world in a notional sense, not in a real way, but the people, I think now have this sense that a lot of those mysteries and unknown elements have gone out of the world because we can just Google everything. We can see YouTube videos of every location. And so I thought, well, what better way to prove that actually that's not the case and that there still are so many unknown elements to our world than to hone in on the most visited locations on the planet and then really try and do some research and dig into those places and find stories that even locals were not aware of. And that was one of the things that really gave me a kick while I was writing the book, is that when I came up with ideas for some of these unknown stories behind the marvels was to actually chat with locals about it, even just literally walking up to random people when I was in Paris and just saying, look, I'm just wondering, I'm thinking about writing a book. have you ever heard of this story behind the Eiffel Tower, to make sure that it wasn't just something that perhaps in my head I thought was unknown, but actually was maybe fairly widely known. So, yeah, that gave me a kick when I was actually able to go up to even locals who were completely unaware of some of these stories. So, yeah, that's the idea behind it.
Yeah, we'll get back to the Eiffel Tower. But before we leave this, yeah, you're so right. I think there's this idea that with AI generating so much of the knowledge consumption in the world, that we're going to know what things mean, what their histories are. But I saw this fascinating chart the other day, something like 15% of the answers being given on AI are generated from looking at Reddit. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's the source. That's where we're getting all our answers from.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're right. You're not going to get the type of deep, detailed, nuanced look at the world's great sites that you do in your book. So let's talk first about one of the oldest sites in the book.
Yep.
I'm talking about the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, formerly known Constantinople, 1,500 years old, and yet it was built in a time of actual darkness. Can you tell a little bit of the story about what was going on in then Constantinople while this great, I guess it was built as a church, then it was a mosque, then a museum, and now a mosque again. But at that point in time, it was supposed to be one of the world's greatest churches.
Yeah, so it was being built at the time as the world's biggest church was the plan, and it was going to be this landmark of Constantinople, which at the time was the capital of the Byzantine Empire. And then there was something like 10,000 craftsmen that were working on it, and then one day basically they went into work and the sun was completely obscured, and everyone within Istanbul, or Constantinople, I should say, was, you know, wondering what had happened. They woke up the next day, the sun is still obscured. A week goes by, a month goes by, and still the city is in practical darkness every single day. And at that time, obviously, they didn't have the kind of science that we have now to try and explain what's going on. Now, when we have natural phenomena, very quickly, scientists come forth on the news and they're able to explain in quite a bit of detail as to what has happened, and it puts people at ease. Yet, even if that happened in the modern day, if suddenly we woke up and the sky went dark, no amount of explaining from scientists would stop us from panicking, even in this day and age. Well, back then, they didn't have the science. And so people went straight to panicky notions of the end of the world, of some kind of cataclysm. And so basically, the city went into complete panic. That was actually the least of their concerns, because the knock-on effect of this was that it actually went on for nearly 18 months of this near darkness, which wasn't just in Istanbul, but was actually spread out across a large part of the Northern Hemisphere. And because the sun was blocked for so long, it caused unseasonable cold, extreme cold weather, which caused drought, famine, disease, and there was an untold number of deaths that occurred all the way across Turkey and Constantinople due to all of these factors. And so this went on, and basically at the time they were just calling it a mystery cloud, and they had no idea what had caused it. And eventually one day the sky just opened up again and things went back to normal, and gradually the city kind of overcame that. And it was just described in history books essentially as a mystery cloud for century after century after century. And it's only in recent years that we've actually started to get a sense of what it was that happened. And in 2018, there was some US scientists who did some analysis of a Swiss glacier. And the analysis that they did, basically, they cut these incredibly narrow ribbons out of the glacier. And the way it works is that they're able to work out where with each of these ribbons, they correspond to an exact year in history because of the layers in the ice and the way that it settles. And so they isolated the ribbon that corresponded with the year 536 AD, which is when this this mystery cloud first started. And they then were able to analyze within the ice, and they found particular kind of chemical elements that are associated with volcanic eruptions. And then they were able to do further research into that, and they were able to pinpoint it that they believe that in Iceland in that year, there was an absolutely gigantic volcanic eruption that sent a blanket of ash and continued to send more and more ash across the Northern Hemisphere for up to 18 months, and that it basically played havoc with the climate during that time. And so basically at that stage in Constantinople, the workmen who were building the Hagia Sophia, they continued working on it, and they were literally working by light, by like torchlight, by candlelight, for
crazy.
That entire 18 months and continued on with that. And even after that happened, then when the mystery cloud finally went away, very soon after that, Istanbul then, or Constantinople, was just hit with more and more natural disasters. In a few years after that, the plague of Justinian descended on them and caused an extraordinary number of deaths. Then there was two giant earthquakes.
Wait, before you leave that, the plague of Justinian was the bubonic plague, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so Constantinople as well was one of the worst locations that was hit by that. There was thousands of people dying a day. And then literally within
You said 10,000 a day in the book, which is extraordinary amount.
Absolutely phenomenal amount. I mean, this is really within a couple of years after the sun has turned back on in Constantinople. They're hit by this plague. And then very soon after that, there was two gigantic earthquakes that hit Constantinople, one of which badly damaged the dome of the Hagia Sophia, and which may have even triggered a tsunami, which damaged Istanbul, which is something that scientists have continued to look into because they found some evidence that there may have been a tsunami that followed one of those earthquakes. So all of this happened really in the space, to Constantinople in the space of about a decade. So it must have just felt at the time as if they were really experiencing the full wrath of the gods.
Yeah. Do you know, you don't say this in the book, but is there any writings from the time that tie these events to the building of the church? Did people think, oh, if we finish this church, which was meant to be the largest in Christendom, these plagues will stop happening? Or do we not know that? Because it was a long time ago, 1,500 years ago.
I didn't come across anything specifically referencing the building of the Hagia Sophia. There is quite a few accounts that were written by scholars at the time who were talking it and describing the impact and describing the terror that was going through Europe and through Constantinople. And some of those descriptions are really quite haunting. But there was no mention specifically of the impact that it had on the Hagia Sophia and its construction.
Right. And one thing I should say about the book, and now that we're doing this also on video, so you can actually see photos, it's filled with gorgeous, gorgeous photos, the book is. And I'm just looking at the page I should be going to. And you talk about symbolism.
I mentioned that as well. Sorry to interrupt. I also photographed the whole book as well. So I traveled to 23 countries to do the photography for the book, and then also wrote the entire book by myself as well.
Yeah. So here's the interior of the Hagia Sophia, and you can see close-ups of it's just this place of extraordinary mosaics. I was there. My goodness. Well, it was still a museum. Now it is a mosque again, which means that not everybody can go into all parts of the structure anymore.
Yes.
Visitors have to go to the second floor, which gives you a pretty good viewing of those mosaics. You're closer to them generally on the second floor. But there's also symbolism within the church, which has ancient tales associated. Yes, I loved the story of Mary's pillar, that Mary, the Virgin Mary, heard about the torture of her son and cried so profusely that it caused a hole in a pillar. And you think, okay, the church is being built because of Jesus's resurrection. So how could Mary have cried a pillar, a hole into a pillar? It's an interesting timeline, but fascinating that believers would go and see these different symbols within the church and what they would take from it.
And that's still called the weeping column, they call it. And there is that hole within the column, and people still go up and put their hands into it or peer into it, take photos with it. So it still has that significance.
Yeah. So we'll go from the ancient Hagia Sophia to one of the newest tourist attractions, which are the gardens in Singapore. Singapore's Gardens by the Bay. You've probably seen photos of these. They look like something out of science fiction. These big metal structures that look like trees, and to me look very unnatural. And yet Singapore as a city is actually one of the greenest, most natural cities on the planet, right?
Yeah. So in the 1960s, their government decided that they wanted to create what they called a garden city. And so they started this project at the time, which was called 60 Years of Greening. And it was something that was very ambitious, you know, probably a little bit of a pie in the sky kind of project at the time. But their aim was that they wanted to become the greenest city on the planet. And so now there is no official rankings for the greenest cities on the planet. But at the moment, Singapore is more than 40% covered by green space, which is about triple the global average. And there was a study done a couple of years ago by MIT, and they found during their research that Singapore was the greenest city of any of the ones that they tested around the world. And it's been a project basically that has also had a lot of people power involved in it. It's not just been government that has been funding it. There's been something like 50,000 volunteers who have been involved in this project. So they've been involved in planting trees, in tending to hundreds of community gardens that are spread out through the city. And they also, there's a lot of volunteers that work at places like Gardens by the Bay, which, because the government, in part of this 60 Years of Greening project, they also invested heavily in eco-attractions and in nature reserves, like Garden by the Bay. And so when you're going through Gardens by the Bay as a tourist, you might notice someone who's weeding or, you know, cutting the lawn somewhere. A lot of those are actually just Singaporean residents who volunteer there. And it's a real point of pride for the Singaporeans how green their city is. And particularly for a lot of Singaporeans, they live in high-rise buildings because it is a very, you know, heavily populated country or city state which has a small amount of land. So for them, I think they see it as all of these gardens are kind of like their backyard because they live in skyscrapers in high-rise condominiums. So there's a real community feel to a lot of these places. And Gardens by the Bay has been key to that because you mentioned, for example, the super trees, as they're called, which are these huge metallic structures, which are then draped on the outside in hundreds of different types of plants, this greenery that spreads all the way up to the top of them. And in the nighttime, you know, they're extremely popular because they become illuminated in the evening and there's a light and sound show. And all of that is actually powered by solar panels that are embedded within these super trees. And that kind of eco technology is then spread out through Gardens by the Bay. So when people are there, it's a very photogenic place. It's very, you know, futuristic looking and so much beautiful greenery. But in behind all of that, you wouldn't notice it, but there's all of this eco-technology that's built into it, and it really helps it to be, you know, part of this overall project of trying to make Singapore the greenest city in the world.
Right. Well, there's two things to that. A, it's sustainable. They have specially tempered glass over the largest greenhouse in the world. Who knew? They've got this network of cooling pipes below it, because Singapore is legendary in terms of the intensity of the heat and humidity there. And so to have this type of greenery in that type of environment, it has to be supported. What I didn't know is a lot of this is being studied by scientists. So it wasn't just created as a nice way for Singaporeans to get some green in their lives or for to bring in tourists. They're doing major scientific research on these futuristic structures, right?
Yeah. Yep. And there's a whole team of scientists and botanists that work in the background there, and they're constantly doing different sorts of scientific projects. And a lot of them now as well are working on trying to source the right type of plants for the next kind of iteration of Gardens by the Bay, which is called Bay East Garden, which is opening up on the other side of the water from Gardens by the Bay in the next sort of 2 or 3 years. That's going to have up to 1 million plants in there. And they actually sent some of the scientists and botanists from Gardens by the Bay were actually sent over to Central and South America to locations that had very similar climates. And they were sent there to try and find the most unique plants possible that they'd be able to bring back to these to the new Bay East Garden when it opens. And in doing so, they were actually replicating a journey that was done in the 1960s by Singaporean scientists at the start of this whole 60 years of greening project. They sent a lot of scientists over to South and Central America to try and find the best possible plants that they'd be able to use to try and beautify the city, but also things that would be sustainable, that would also have the ability to benefit their own environment. It's been really interesting now to see them, you know, six decades later, they're sending scientists again back over to kind of retrace the steps of those pioneers back in the 1960s.
Fascinating. So we have covered two places. What I love about the book is it toggles back and forth between looking at these sites in a meta way, you know, holistically about the whole structure of different sites. And then sometimes you look at a person who very much influenced history and who had an unusual tie with an iconic site. In this case, I'm talking about Mata Hari. Mata Hari is a name that I think a lot of people have heard, but they really don't know the story behind the actual person who was Mata Hari. So can you tell her story, and then we'll talk about the iconic landmark that she is associated with, or that you associated with her with?
Yeah, so she was a Dutch woman, and when she was her story basically, takes a turn when she was 18. She decided to marry a Dutch soldier and then followed him to Indonesia, where he was based, which at the time was still a Dutch territory. And they had two children, a young boy and a young girl. And after a couple of years, both of their children became poisoned. And it's still a point of contention as to how that exactly happened. But unfortunately, the young boy died and the girl, their daughter, managed to survive. But it basically signaled the end of their marriage. And Mata Hari and her Dutch soldier husband, they parted ways and they both moved back to Europe. And at the time then, Mata Hari, she just did not have the funds to be able to provide for her daughter, whereas her husband was much more well off. So she had to give her daughter up, and her husband was looking after the daughter. And she then, Mata Hari, basically had to try and come up with a way to support herself, and particularly with this burning goal of trying to build enough wealth that she'd be able to look after her daughter and get her daughter back. And her name then actually at the time was Margaretha, but she then decided that how she was going to make money was by becoming a burlesque dancer. And she basically built this alter ego, which was cobbled together from various Asian nations. And she decided to call herself Matahari, which was a Malay term for the sun. But she also then incorporated into her dances and into her outfits other elements of Asian culture. And she quickly became really successful and started performing all over Europe, started making really quite a remarkable amount of money. And in the process as well, she just entranced, a huge number of men, including a sequence of very powerful, wealthy lovers. And she became very influential then and very famous. And then World War I came along, and this basically, put a halt to her career because she wasn't able to perform in all of these big cities around Europe. She wasn't able to move so freely around. And then one day she gets approached by a German official who has obviously scouted her out and decided that she would make a very good spy. The reason being that her work gave her good cover for traveling because she'd always traveled. So they wanted her traveling around as much as possible, and she had a cover story for that. But also, even more importantly, was that she was well known to have had relationships with all these powerful men, including many powerful French men, and that she had the ability to really kind of cast a spell over men. And so they then believed that that would be a great source of information for them. So basically she started funneling a lot of very valuable information to the Germans, and to the extent that the French later claimed that the intelligence that she was supplying to the Germans led to the deaths of about 50,000 French soldiers. Which is extraordinary to think that one person could have that much of an impact, especially someone who's not even trained as a spy, who's just sort of picking it up out of nowhere. And then she also started spying for the French at the same time. And until she eventually was arrested as a double agent by the French and was executed in Paris. And
now let's before we get to how they caught her, let's cut to another history, which is the history of the Eiffel Tower briefly, and then let's talk about how the two connect. So when do you have at your fingertips when the Eiffel Tower was first erected and how long it was supposed to be in place?
From memory, I think it was 1887, thereabouts. So it was built as an exhibition structure, and it was only really meant to be in place for around a decade or so, and then it was going to be demolished. And its designer, Gustave Eiffel, he was desperate for his creation, his beloved creation, to remain. And so he tried to come up with different new uses that that would make it useful so they wouldn't need to demolish it. And one of the ideas that he came up with was that it could operate as a communications tower, being the tallest point in France at the time and one of the tallest points in all of the world at that stage. And so that was accepted by the French government, and they turned it into this telecommunications tower. Then all of a sudden, 10 years or so later, World War I happens, and suddenly the Eiffel Tower becomes an incredibly important piece, a tool for the French, because it was enabling them to intercept messages that were being sent, telecommunications that were being sent, and they were able to actually often be one step ahead of the Germans, and the Germans couldn't quite work out why this was happening. Anyway, eventually they came across some particular communications that were referring to a spy who had had repeated meetings with the Germans, and they were then able to dig into this and found out that it was in fact Matahari who was this spy, who at the time, as I said, was very famous in France. And so it was literally via the Eiffel Tower and its use as a tool of espionage that Mata Hari's time as a spy finally ended, and she was then executed as a result of that.
And you don't make any jokes about the Mata Hari's supposed control over men and the shape of the tower. But to me, there seemed to be some irony in the fact that it was the Eiffel Tower that really kind of brought her down. A fascinating story. And I think a lot of people who go to the Eiffel Tower had no idea how endangered it was, first of all, because it seems like a symbol of the city now. But it was not at all popular when it was first built, and how it really shaped world history and the history of that war. Really fascinating. You also talk about a very modern tower, the Burj Khalifa, and it kind of breaks my heart. It's in Dubai, which is an area we may not be able to visit again for quite some time. We'll see. Yeah. And I love the fact that you look at this as one of the most important contemporary structures created on the planet that has had a remarkable effect in saving an ancient form of architecture. Tell us about that.
So, yeah, when people visit the Burj Khalifa, the main thing that they do is they go up to the 125th floor, which has got this incredible lookout, a 360-degree lookout. And from there, you can look all the way up and down the UAE coast, down towards Abu Dhabi. You can see the whole of Dubai. And it's, you know, you are more than well over 700 meters up in the air. And the view is absolutely extraordinary. So it's understandable that people, while they're on this lookout, may not look up towards the ceiling. But if they did, what they would notice is that this incredibly beautiful lattice work that covers the whole ceiling and is lit up in different colors at different times, blue and red lighting. And this is actually an ancient form of Islamic design called mashrabiya. And this dates back about 1,000 years, and it actually originated as essentially an ancient form of air conditioning. So at the time, obviously, as it is now in the Middle East, it can be extremely hot. So they had to come up with unique design elements for homes and for communal buildings as to how to manage that heat. And so the idea with mashrabiya is that instead of having windows on the outside of a building, what you would have instead is this lattice, stone lattice or sometimes wooden lattice work on the outside of the building. And that blocked a lot of the sunlight from getting into the home, but it allowed the air flow to flow in and out. So in that way, it was like a very early form of air conditioning, but it also had all these geometric patterns within it. And each form of mashrabiya from one building to the next could look completely different. And so it was also very much an artistic element to these buildings and beautified these buildings. But then in the 1900s, as modern air conditioning came along, there was no functional need for mashrabiya anymore. And so it really did start to die out because it had started off 1,000 years ago in Egypt, and then had become really popular for about 500 years ago in Iraq, and it spread throughout the Middle East. But by the 1900s, in most of those countries, it just wasn't being used anymore. There were still older buildings that had it. But then Burj Khalifa, when it was designed, they really made an effort to try and incorporate Islamic designs and motifs within the building. Because it wasn't just this huge landmark for Dubai, it was also a sort of a source of pride for the Arab world, because it was the first time in about 700 years that the tallest building in the world was in the Middle East, the last time being the Pyramid of Giza. And so they wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a generic modern skyscraper. And so there's a lot of different design elements within Burj Khalifa that are nods to ancient Islamic design. And mashrabiya is one of those key elements. And the knock-on effect of that has been that it's sort of a signaled a bit of a resurgence of mashrabiya as a decorative element, within buildings in the Middle East. So ever since Burj Khalifa used it on their building, there's been dozens of new constructions throughout the Middle East that are now using this Mashrabiya lattice work on the outside of buildings or inside in all these different ways as a celebration of, you know, Arab and Islamic ingenuity from many years in the past.
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating and so unexpected that, you know, the symbol of modernity had these elements that really called out the best of the past. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Let me show you it again. It is called Hidden in Plain Sight, The Untold Mysteries, Myths, and Marvels of the World's Most Popular Landmarks. Thank you so much, Ronan, for appearing on the Fromer Travel Show.
Yeah, thank you, Pauline. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, my pleasure. And that is it for this week's show. If you like the Fromer Travel Show, won't you give us a nice star rating wherever you listen to podcasts? And let me end by saying to those who are traveling, may I wish you a very hearty bon voyage.
It's been so long, and I cannot help but wonder. coming home. I like you with your sour candy in the boathouse on the lake. But I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. I hate the way it tastes. Oh, it's been so long. And I can't help but wonder, are you ever coming home? When I see you with your sour candy, don't want it any other way. Oh, I just hate, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. I hate the way it tastes.
Hey guys, Aaron Miller here from Armchair Explorer, and I just wanted to let you know that our new series is out now. We've got kite skiing across Antarctica, Aboriginal storytellers, and the craziest whitewater race in the world. We're going on a bucket list hike across Italy. We're going to the fjords of Norway in search of the Northern Lights, and lots, lots more. Our goal is to take you on the trip of a lifetime every single week. You can find Armchair Explorer on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening right now, and at voyescape.com.
If you want to travel more, ideally in luxury, but without the luxury price tag, this show is for you. I'm DeAndre Koch, and on Revolutionizing Your Journey, I use my unique vantage point as a financial advisor to break down exactly how my wife and I leverage credit card points and miles to fly business class, stay at five-star resorts, and take bucket list trips for a fraction of the cost. Each week, I share real strategies packed with actionable tips and interview some of the smartest travelers in the game to help you revolutionize the way you travel. Travel well, live boldly, and find Revolutionizing Your Journey wherever you get your podcasts.